Taita signalled the two vehicles that followed him to halt. They stopped in the purple shade thrown across the sands by a tall, slip-faced dune, shaped like the elegant curve of a gigantic seashell. The horses were already showing signs of distress. They hung their heads and their chests heaved as they breathed. The sweat had dried in salt-white rime on their dust-dulled hides. Carefully they measured out a water ration from the water skins into the leather buckets, and the horses drank eagerly. Taita treated Mintaka's feet, and was relieved to find that no evidence that the injuries were mortifying. When he'd retied the bandages, he led Bay out of earshot of the others. "We're being overlooked," he said flatly. "There's a baleful influence slowly enveloping us."
"I have felt it also," Bay agreed. "And I have begun to resist it. But it is powerful."
"We can best frustrate it if we combine our powers against it."
"We must be careful of the others. They are more vulnerable."
"I will warn them to be on their guard." Taita walked back to where the others were just finishing the watering. "Be ready to go on," he told Nefer. "Bay and I are going to scout the ground ahead. We will return in a short while."
The two adepts went forward on foot and disappeared around the curved sand wall of the slip face. Out of sight of the chariots, they halted.
"Do you know who Trok has with him who can work such a potent spell?"
"He has priests and sorcerers with all his regiments. But the most powerful of them is Ishtar the Mede."
"I know of him," Taita nodded. "He works in fire and blood. We must try to turn his influence back on him."
Bay started a small fire of dried horse dung, and when it was burning steadily, they pricked the ends of their thumbs and squeezed out a few red drops into the flames. With the whiff of burnt blood in the air, they faced the enemy, for they could feel that the influence was in the western segment from the direction that they had come. They exerted their combined powers, and after a while they felt it begin to diminish and disperse, like the smoke of the dying fire. When they'd completed the ritual and were smothering the fire with sand, Bay said softly,
"It is still there."
"Yes," Taita said. "We have weakened it, but it is still dangerous, especially to those who have not learned how to resist it."
"The youngest will be more susceptible," Bay suggested. "The two boys, Pharaoh and Merin, and the girl."
They went back to where the chariots waited. Before they mounted again, Taita spoke to the others. He knew that they would be frightened if he mentioned the true reason for his concern, so he said,
"We are entering the most inhospitable and dangerous area of the Dune Lands. I know that you're all tired and thirsty, drained by the rigors of the journey. But it could be fatal for any of you to become careless. Watch the horses and the ground ahead. Do not allow yourselves to be distracted by any strange sound or by an unusual sight, a bird or an animal."
He paused and looked directly at Nefer.
"That applies to you particularly, Your Majesty. Be on your guard at all times."
Nefer nodded and for once did not argue. The rest of them also looked grave, realizing that Taita had some reason of his own to give them this warning. As they went forward again, following the valleys between the high dunes, the heat seemed to increase with every turn of the chariot wheels. The loose sand walls that rose on either side took on a motley of vivid colors, lemon yellow and gold, plum purple and heron blue, fox red and tawny lion brown. In places the dunes were streaked with frosty talc, or etched with patterns of black sand like the soot of an oil lamp. Overhead, the sky turned brazen and ferocious. The quality of light changed. It became yellow and ethereal. Distances were rendered confusing and distorted. Nefer slitted his eyes against the shimmering glare of the brassy sky. It seemed close enough to touch with the end of his whip. At the same time, the shape of Taita's vehicle, only 50 cubits ahead,
seemed to recede to a blurred and distant horizon. The heat scorched any exposed skin on face or body. Nefer felt a formless dread take hold of him. There was no reason for it, but he could not shake it off. When Mintaka shuddered against him and gripped his whip arm, he knew that she'd sensed it too. Great evil hung in the air. He wanted to call out to Taita to ask him for guidance and reassurance, but his throat was closed by dust and heat. No sound issued from it. Suddenly, at his side, he felt Mintaka stiffen, and her fingers dug painfully into the biceps of his whip arm. He looked down at her face and saw that she was terrified. With her free hand, she pointed frantically to the crest of the dune that seemed to hang suspended above them. Something colossal and dark detached itself from the heights and began to tumble down towards them. He had never seen anything like it. It had the same weighty, amorphous shape as a monstrous waterskin, but was so large that it covered the entire side of the dune, large enough to engulf and squash not only the three chariots below it, but an entire regiment. As it rolled down the almost sheer slope, it gathered speed, undulating, wobbling and bouncing silently, coming down on them so swiftly that it blotted out the yellow desert sky. In the heat, it exuded a sudden cold that squeezed their breath from their lungs as if they'd plunged into an icy pool in a high mountain stream. The horses had seen it also. They plunged wildly and swung off the sandy track and bolted across the valley bottom, trying to outrun the terrifying apparition. There was a field of ragged black lava rocks directly ahead of them, and they were racing straight into it. Nefer realized the danger and tried to turn their heads, but they were out of control. As he wrestled with the reins, Mintaka was screaming beside him. Certain that they were about to be overwhelmed by the dark monstrosity, Nefer glanced over his shoulder. He expected it to be looming over them, for he could feel the cold emanation on the back of his neck. But there was nothing. The side of the dune was bare, smooth, and silent. The yellow sky above was empty and bright. The other two chariots were halted under the slope, the horses calm and under control. Taita and the others were staring at them, astonished.
"Whoa!"
Nefer yelled at the runaway team, and threw his full weight on the reins, but the horses never checked. At full gallop they flew into the field of lava rock, with the chariot bounding and swerving behind them.
"Whoa!" he screamed again. "Stop, curse you, stop!"
The horses were mad with terror, far beyond restraint. They arched their necks to fight the reins, striding out at full strength, grunting with every stride.
"Hold hard, Mintaka!"
Nefer shouted and threw one arm around her shoulders to protect her. "We're going to strike!" The black rocks were worn and carved by wind-blown sand into strange shapes. Some were the size of a man's head, and others as big as the chariot under them. Nefer managed to steer the crazed horses clear of the first, but they ran on into a gap between two of the largest rocks. It was too narrow for them to pass through. The off-wheel struck with a rending crash and disintegrated. Shattered spokes and sections of the rim were hurled into the air. The carriage dropped onto its axle, dragging down the off-horse, which was thrown onto the next rock. Nefer heard its front legs snap like kindling, even as he and Mintaka were hurled clear of it. They hit the soft sand, narrowly avoiding being thrown into the rock that had maimed the horse. When they came to a standstill, Nefer was still holding Mintaka in his arms. He had cushioned her fall, and now he demanded breathlessly,
"Are you all right? Are you hurt?"
"No," she answered at once.
"Are you?"
Nefer came to his knees and stared in horror at the wreckage of the chariot and the crippled horses.
"Sweet Horus," he cried. "We're finished!"
The chariot was smashed beyond any hope of repair. One horse was down for ever, both front legs shattered. The other was standing, still in its traces and harnessed to the single shaft of the chariot. But one leg was swinging loosely from its dislocated shoulder. Unsteadily he came to his feet and pulled Mintaka up after him. They clung to each other as Taita drove his chariot to the edge of the lava field, tossed the reins to Merin, and jumped down from the footplate. He came to them with long strides.
"What happened? What caused the horses to bolt?"
"Did you not see it?"
Nefer asked, still shaken and bewildered.
"What was it?"
Taita insisted.
A thing! Dark and huge as a mountain. It rolled down the dune on top of us.
Nefer groped for words to describe what they'd seen.
It was as big as the temple of Hathor,
Mintaka supported him.
It was terrifying. You must have seen it also.
No, Taita replied. It was an aberration of your mind and vision, something placed there by our enemies.
Witchcraft?
Nefer was bemused.
But the horses saw it also.
Taita turned away from them and called to Hilto as he drove up. Destroy those poor beasts, he pointed to the maimed horses. Help him, Nefer. Taita wanted to distract him from the disaster and its consequences. With a heavy heart, Nefer held the head of the downed horse. He stroked its forehead and covered its eyes with his headcloth so that it would not see death coming. Hilto was an old trooper and had done this sad work on many far-flung battlefields. He placed the point of the dagger behind the animal's ear and with a single thrust drove it into the brain. The horse stiffened, shivered, and then relaxed. They went to the second animal. It dropped instantly to Hilto's thrust and lay without moving again. Taita and Bay stood together watching this harrowing act of mercy, and Bay said softly,
The mead is stronger than I thought him to be. He has singled out the most vulnerable among us and directed his powers at them.
He has Trok's other sorcerers to reinforce his influence. From now onwards we will have to watch over Hilto and Mirren also,
Taita agreed.
Until I can gather my own force to oppose Ishtar, we are in great danger.
He left Bay's side. It would trouble the others if they saw the two of them conferring secretly together. It was of the utmost importance to keep up their spirits.
Bring the water skins, Taita ordered.
One had burst in the crash, and the other two were only half full, but they strapped them on to the remaining chariots.
From here onwards, Mirren will ride with Hilto and Bay. I'll take their majesties with me.
With the water skins and the weight of the extra passengers, the chariots were now overloaded. The horses were straining as they went forward into the glaring heat, with the lurid sun almost obscured by the strange yellow overcast. Taita held the golden periapt of Lostris in his right hand and chanted softly to himself, warding off the evil that was thickening everywhere around them. In the following chariot, Bay was singing also a monotonous, repetitive refrain. They came to a section of the road where the wind had wiped away the tracks of other caravans and travellers. There were no signs to follow except for the small cairns of stones that had been placed at intervals. Eventually even these petered out, and they went on into the trackless sands. They relied now on Taita's experience, his knowledge of the desert, and his deep instincts. At last they came out into flat ground between two ranges of high dunes. The sand here was smooth and level, but Taita stopped at the edge of it and considered it carefully. He climbed down from the footplate and beckoned to Bay. The black man came to his side, and together they examined the innocuous surface.
I like it not at all, Taita said. We must look for a detour around this plain. There is something here.
Bay walked a short way out onto the firm level sand and sniffed the hot air. He spat twice and studied the pattern of his own spittle. Then he came back to Taita.
I can find nothing troublesome here. If we look for our way round, it may cost us hours, even days. The pursuit is not far behind. We must decide which is the greater risk.
There is something, Taita repeated. Like you, I also feel an impulse to cross here. That feeling is too strong and illogical. The idea has been placed in our minds by the mead.
Mighty Magus, Bay shook his head. In this case, I do not agree with you. We must take the risk and cross this valley. Otherwise, Trok will catch up with us before nightfall.
Taita took him by the shoulders and stared into his black eyes. He saw that they were slightly unfocused, as though he'd been smoking the bhang weed. "The mead has penetrated your armor," he said, and placed the periapt on Bay's forehead. Bay blinked and opened his eyes wide. Taita could see him struggling to throw off the influence. He exerted his own will to help him. At last, Bay shivered and his gaze cleared.
"You are right," he whispered. "Ishtar has overlooked me. There is a great danger in this place."
They looked down the length of the narrow valley. It was a river of yellow sand with no beginning and no end in sight. The far bank was close, no more than 300 cubits across at the narrowest places, but it might have been 200 leagues, and Trok's regiments were close behind them.
"South or north?" Bay asked. "I cannot see the way round."
Taita closed his eyes and exerted all his powers. Suddenly, there was a sound in the terrible silence. A faint high cry. They all looked up and saw the tiny shape of a royal falcon turning high in the furious yellow sky. It circled twice, then sped south along the valley and disappeared into the haze. "South," Taita said. "We will follow the falcon." They had been so intent on these deliberations that neither of them had noticed that Hilto had eased his own chariot up closer to where they stood. He and Merrin were leaning over the dashboard and listening to this exchange. Hilto was frowning with impatience. Suddenly he exclaimed,
"Enough of this! The way's clear ahead! We cannot afford any delay! Will you dare to follow if Hilto leads the way?"
He whipped up his team and the startled horses jumped forward. Merrin was taken so completely by surprise that he was almost thrown backwards over the footplate, but he grabbed a handhold and managed to stay the racing vehicle. Taita shouted at Hilto, "Come back! You are bewitched! You do not know what you're doing!" Bay jumped up to catch the harness of the offside horse, but he was too late. The chariot sped past him and out onto the flat ground. It gathered speed, and Hilto's laughter floated back to them.
"The way is open! 'Tis smooth and fast!"
Nefer snatched up the reins of the stationary vehicle and shouted,
"I'll stop him and turn him!"
"No!"
Taita turned back to him, desperately raising his hand in a command to stop.
"Don't go out there! There is danger! Stop, Nefer!"
But Nefer ignored his cries. With Mintaka beside him, he lashed up the team, and the wheels sang over the smooth, hard sand. He was catching up with Hilto rapidly.
"Oh, sweet Horus!" Taita groaned. "Watch the wheels!"
A fine feather of silver sand began to rise from behind the spinning wheels of Hilto's chariot. Then, as they watched in horror, the feather became a thick plume of yellow slush, then slabs of loose mud. The horses slowed as they sank to their hocks in the soft footing, and lumps of mud were thrown up so high from their driving hooves that they flew over Hilto's head. He made no attempt to stop or turn back, but drove them on deeper into the quagmire.
"The sinking sands!" Taita cried bitterly. "This is the work of the Mede! He's hidden the true road and led us into this trap!"
Abruptly, Hilto's team broke through the crust into the treacherous swamp beneath. As its wheels dropped in over the rims, the chariot came to such a sudden halt that both Hilto and Merrin were catapulted over the dashboard. They rolled across the innocent-seeming surface, but when they came to a stop and tried to stand up, their bodies were covered with sticky yellow mud, and immediately they sank in to their knees. The horses were completely mired. Only their heads and front quarters were free, but as they whinnied and plunged, they sank deeper and deeper still. Nefer was bemused and reacted too slowly to the disaster taking place before his eyes. By the time he attempted to turn back, it was too late. Within 10 cubits, his wheels were in over the hubs, and both horses were bogged down to the shoulders. He jumped down to help them, to try to unharness them and lead them back, but immediately he was trapped in the slimy mud, sinking into his knees and then to the waist.
"Don't try to stand," Mintaka warned him frantically. "It will swallow you under. Throw yourself flat and swim."
She threw herself headlong from the sinking vehicle and lay flat on the quaking mud.
"Like this, Nefer. Do as I do."
He recovered his wits and stretched out flat on the surface. In an awkward swimming motion, like a child learning to doggy paddle, he reached the chariot before it disappeared completely. With his dagger he cut the leather straps that held the floorboards in place, and in desperate haste ripped them up and threw them clear. They floated on the surface of the deadly quicksands, but the heavy-laden chariot slid inexorably below the surface and drew the horses down with it. Within minutes there was only a lighter patch on the dun-coloured plain to mark their grave. Hilto's chariot had also been drawn under, and his horses with it. He and Merrin were floundering about, yelling with terror, managing only to keep their mud-daubed heads and shoulders clear. Nefer shoved one of the floorboards to Mintaka. "Use this!" he ordered her, and she crawled onto it. He did the same with another board, which supported his weight. Towing two more boards with him by their leather straps, he propelled himself across the swamp until he was close enough to throw them to Hilto and Merrin. They dragged themselves out of the glutinous clutches of the mud. All four started to swim laboriously back towards where Taita and Bay watched in horror from firm ground. Taita waved his arms and shouted urgently, "You are already halfway across! Don't return here! Go on! Cross to the other side!" Nefer saw the sense in this immediately. They turned for the far bank. It was slow, hard work, for the mud clung tenaciously to their arms and legs and to the bottom of the boards. Mintaka's lighter weight soon told, and she drew ahead of the others. She was the first to reach firm ground and to drag herself from the clutches of the sinking sands. At last, Nefer, Hilto, and Merrin followed her. They were almost exhausted. They threw themselves down at the foot of the eastern dunes. While they crossed, there had been time for Taita to consider their predicament. It seemed hopeless. They were split into two groups, with a gulf between them 200 cubits wide. They had lost all of their horses and vehicles, their weapons and equipment. But the worst loss of all was the precious water skins. Now Bay touched his arm and whispered, "Listen." It was a susurration in the air, far off, sometimes fading away, then growing louder again, a distant echo reverberating from the enclosing dunes. Though faint, it was unmistakable, the sound of a column of chariot cavalry on the march. The three mud-soaked figures on the far side of the valley heard it also, and came to their feet. All of them stared back into the dunes and listened to Chok and his men coming on apace. Suddenly Mintaka ran back to the edge of the quagmire where they'd abandoned the boards that had carried them across. Nefer stared after her, trying to fathom out what she intended. She gathered up the boards and waded out knee-deep, dragging the boards after her by their leather straps. Nefer realized suddenly what she was doing, but he was too late to stop her. She threw herself flat on one of the boards and began to skim out over the yellow mud. She was out of his reach when at last he was forced to stop waist-deep. "Come back!" he shouted after her. "I'll go!"
"I'm lighter and faster than you!"
she called back, and though he went on pleading with her, she ignored him and used all her breath and strength on skimming forward. The sound of chariots grew louder and spurred Mintaka on to greater effort. Watching her, Nefer was torn with fear for her safety and anger for her intransigence. But even stronger was his pride in her courage. "She has the heart of a warrior and a queen," he whispered as she drew closer to the far bank. Now they could hear the voices of the pursuers and the rattle of wheels and the clank of weapons, magnified by the sounding board of the dunes. Taita tucked his staff under his belt to leave his hands free. Then he and Bay waded out to meet Mintaka. Each took a spare board from her and launched themselves out onto the treacherous surface. All three started to swim back to the east bank. From out of the dunes behind them debouched the head of the column of pursuing chariots. The unmistakable figure of Chok was in the leading vehicle, and his bull voice roared out triumphantly and echoed from the dune walls, "Forward! Charge!" The leading phalanx of chariots broke into full gallop and came tearing towards the edge of the sinking sands.
The three fugitives sculled themselves frantically onto the yellow morass. Behind them the yells of the charioteers grew louder. Trucks bulk forced his wheels to sink deeper into the loose sand than those of the other vehicles, and though his horses strained under the whip, he fell back behind the first rank of the charge. The other three chariots of the leading file ran headlong on into the sinking sands and were sucked in as swiftly as the other vehicles had been engulfed. Thus Trock was alerted to the danger. He managed to bring his own team under control and swerve away from the morass. He seized his short recurved bow from the rack and leapt down. Behind him the other chariots broke the charge and drew up in a mass.
"Bows!" shouted Trock. "Massed volleys! Don't let them get away! Shoot them down!"
The archers ran forward and formed into ranks four deep at the edge of the swamp, full quivers on their backs and bows strung taut. Mintaka had once more pulled ahead of her companions. She had passed the halfway mark, and though they were sculling frantically, Taita and Bay were lagging ever further behind her. Trock strode down the ranks, giving his orders.
"Archers, knock your arrows!"
150 men fitted arrow to bowstring.
"Archers, draw and aim!"
They lifted their weapons and drew to the lip, aiming at the lowering yellow sky.
"Loose!"
Trock yelled, and they fired a massed volley. The arrows rose in a dark cloud. They reached the zenith of their trajectory and fell towards the three small figures out in the swamp. Taita heard them coming and looked back into the sky. The deadly cloud dropped towards them, whistling softly as the wings of a flight of wild geese.
"Into the mud!"
Taita called urgently, and all three slipped off the boards and were immersed in the thick mud until only their heads protruded. The arrows fell thick as hail round them. One pegged deeply into the board on which Mintaka had lain only seconds before.
"Onward!"
Taita ordered, as they hauled themselves back onto the boards and sculled forward again, gaining only a few yards before the air was once more filled with the hum of falling arrows, and they threw themselves back into the protection of the yellow mud. Three more times they were forced to dive off the boards, but each time the range was longer for the archers and the volleys less accurate. Mintaka pulled away even faster than before and was soon out of range. Trock's bellows of rage and frustration followed them as he urged his men to shoot. The arrows plopped into the mud around them, but the fall of the volleys was less concentrated. Taita turned his head to look across at Bay. His huge, scarified head was shining with mud and sweat. His bloodshot eyes bulged from their sockets, and his mouth was wide open, his filed teeth sharp as those of a shark.
"Courage, Bay!"
Taita called to him.
"We're almost across!"
As he said it, he realized that the words were a direct challenge to the gods. On the bank behind them, Trock saw them slipping slowly from his grasp. His troopers were using the shorter and less powerful bows designed to be shot from a running chariot. 200 cubits was the limit of their effective range. Trock turned and glared back at his lance-bearer, who was managing the horses of his team.
"Bring my war bow!"
he shouted. Trock was the only man in the regiment who carried the long bow in his chariot. He decided that for the rest of the troops, the war bow's awkward length did not compensate for the added strength and range. However, Trock's massive strength and the reach of his long arms set him above the strictures placed on lesser men. He used the short recurved bow in most situations. However, he designed a special rack on the side of his chariot to accommodate the extra length of the more powerful but unwieldy weapon. His lance-bearer ran to him and placed the great bow in his hands. He brought also the quiver holding the special arrows, emblazoned with the head of the leopard, that fitted the long weapon. Trock shouldered his way into the front row of archers, and they made way for him. He knocked a long arrow and measured the range with half-closed eyes. The heads of the two swimmers were tiny blobs on the yellow expanse. The men around him were still shooting rapidly, but their arrows fell short, dropping ineffectually into the mud. Mentally, he calculated the angle of release and took his stance with his left foot leading. He sucked in a deep breath and drew with straight left arm until the string touched the tip of his hooked nose. The bow challenged even his strength. The muscles in his bare arms stood proud, and his features contorted with the effort. He held it for a heartbeat, adjusted his aim fractionally. Then he released, and the great bow stock flexed and pulsed in his hands like a living creature. The long arrow blurred as it climbed, high above the clouds of lesser missiles, outstripping them effortlessly. It reached its noon and dropped like a stooping falcon. In the mud, Taita heard the sharper, shriller sound of its flight and looked up. He saw it coming straight at him, and there was no time for him to fall off his primitive craft or even to a duck to avoid it. Involuntarily, he closed his eyes. The arrow passed so close over his head that he felt his hair stirred by the wind of its passage. Then he heard the solid thump of the strike. He opened his eyes and rolled his head towards the sound. The long arrow had taken bay in the middle of his naked back. It had transfixed his body, and the flint head had buried itself in the board on which he lay, pinning him to the wood like a shiny black beetle. Bay's face was only an arm's length from his own. Taita looked into the deep black eyes and saw the agony of death flare in them. Bay opened his mouth to cry out or to speak, but the copious rush of bright blood through his lips drowned any sound. Painfully, he reached up to the necklace round his neck and pulled it loose. He reached out to Taita, offering him, as his last gift, the priceless relic that was twisted around his clawed fingers. Taita gently untangled it from the rigid fingers and dropped the string around his own neck. He felt the essence of the dying shaman flowing from it into his own body, reinforcing his powers. Bay's head dropped forward, but the arrow prevented him rolling off the board. Taita recognized the leopard inlay on the shaft of the arrow and knew who had fired it. He reached across, placed two fingers on Bay's throat, and felt the moment of his passing. Bay was gone, and no effort on his part could save him. He left him and swam onwards to where Nefer and Mintaka stood on the far bank, calling encouragement to him. Four more of the long arrows dropped close to him, but none touched him, and he drew slowly out of their reach. Nefer met him and helped him to his feet in the thick mud. Taita used his staff to help himself onto firm ground. He sagged down, gasping for breath. After only a minute, he sat up again and stared across the sinking sands to where Trok stood on the far bank, arms akimbo, every line of his body and head betraying his rage and frustration. Then Trok cupped his hands round his mouth and shouted, "Think not you have escaped me, warlock! I want you, and I want my bitch back! I will have you both! I will run you down! I will never lose the scent." Mintaka walked forward as far as she could go. She knew exactly where he was most vulnerable and how to humiliate him most painfully in front of his men. "Dear husband, your threats are as flaccid and empty as your loins." Her high, sweet voice carried clearly, and 200 Hyksos warriors heard every word. There was a shocked silence, and then a great roar of mocking laughter went up from their ranks. Even his own men hated Trok enough to take pleasure in his humiliation. Trok brandished his bow above his head and stamped with helpless rage. At last he turned, snarling on his men, and they fell silent, abashed by their own temerity. In the silence, Trok shouted, "Ishtar! Ishtar the Mede, come forward!"